Welcome back to Killer Fun, where we explore the intersection of crime and entertainment every other week. I'm Christy.
And I'm Jackie.
And we're so glad that you're back with us today. Today, we are talking about crime scene, the vanishing at the Cecil Hotel, the first season in a series, anthology series.
Yeah, I think that's how
I think that's how it works. That this is a season that they're doing. It's just 4 episodes.
Right.
About the Cecil Hotel. And they'll presumably do additional seasons about different crime scenes.
Didn't they do one before? Or is this a different group? Because there's been a few of these kinds of things. Yeah. Like the one with the guy who pushed his wife down the stairs, but that was the big mystery.
The staircase. That was independent documentary filmmaker.
So not the same production company.
There are no famous actors in this.
No, because it's a docuseries.
It's a docuseries, but there are famous people attached to it. Mm. So the director is Joe Berlinger, and he's done lots and lots of documentaries dating back to the early 90s. But he was also the director of Extremely Wicked, Shockingly Evil, and Vile.
Ted Bundy.
Ted Bundy, thank you. That we've covered.
Yeah, yeah, I thought that it felt familiar to me. That's probably what I was thinking of.
That's, yeah, a little bit. Mm-hmm. And it's not dissimilar. And so he's, maybe what you're thinking of is the guy, that guy, Joe Berlinger, mm-hmm. he did that. And then he did some other Ted Bundy related stuff. Like something about the tapes. I don't know, tapes where Ted Bundy was interviewed.
Oh, yeah. Wasn't it just called The Tapes?
No.
Maybe not.
It was something else.
Okay, but yes, I saw that too.
Yeah, it was the...
It has a similar thread throughout all of them, a similar flavor to the way that they're kind of produced mm-hmm. and edited and yes. together. And I like it.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like it.
It's good. Mm-hmm. And then the producers are some pretty heavy hitters. Brian Grazer, Arrested Development, A Beautiful Mind, Apollo 13, Splash, all the way back in 1984, which was his first really big thing, and tons of stuff. And then Ron Howard.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, of course. You know, Opie from the Andy Griffith yeah. Show, and how I first remember him, Richie Cunningham from Happy Days.
Oh, yes.
I watched so many Happy Days reruns.
Oh, I loved it. On Nick at Night.
I loved it too. Oh, no, it wasn't on Nick at Night for me, but it was, yeah.
Yeah.
That's where a lot of people saw it. I know. It was so like wholesome and sweet, and you know, everybody loved the Fonz.
Oh, yeah.
Which is so funny because Henry Winkler is such a dork.
I know. Well, that's why he pulled off being so stereotypically cool.
Like he doesn't need to comb his hair. It's already perfect.
Why paint the peacock?
Yeah. And he has worked with Brian Grazer before because he directed A Beautiful Mind. And, you know, he moved from those parts, those mm-hmm. big acting parts, to smaller acting parts so that he could concentrate on directing. And
he's a great director.
Yes, and producing, and he's wonderful at both of those. Mm-hmm. So as at least one of his kids, one of his daughters has directed a number of episodes of The Mandalorian.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. My family would be super interested to know that.
Your family would.
They are very, very attached to that show.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Hey, you not so much.
No, me not so much.
That's fine.
I am the oddball out. But you know what? I'm always the oddball out, so at least some things are consistent.
So let's recap this.
Let's recap.
Okay. So the Cecil Hotel is no stranger to nefarious activity. And it seems this is really well known in the area of Los Angeles where the hotel is, but it's not known to unsuspecting out-of-town tourists. So one such guest was Eliza Lamb, and she was in her early 20s, a Canadian college student, a child of immigrants. She was super excited about doing some traveling because her parents had done some traveling being immigrants, and she had not because her immigrant parents are very protective, understandably. And she shared all of her excitement about her upcoming travels with Tumblr.
She was a social media guru. Yeah, and Tumblr was her platform.
Yes, it was. That was her favorite one, the one she felt most kinship with other users, where she felt she was able to express herself. Mm-hmm. Eliza was given permission to go, but only if she checked in every single day with her parents, which in hindsight, very, very wise stipulation to make. I thought it was a little weird that at 21, she had to get such permission from her parents. And you find out in later episodes, maybe why. But we'll get to that a little later. So when she did not check in, her parents went to the police right away.
Immediately.
Like, immediately. And so this is where we get introduced to anybody who might have any kind of insight into Eliza Lamb's disappearance. Detectives, the hotel manager, historians, internet sleuths who are hoping to help, journalists, maintenance staff, sociologists, a former resident of the area. I mean, anybody who was in the area or had ever been in that area practically. They
came out of the woodwork.
I mean, really, they like tried to interview those people. The one thing we don't get is anybody who knew her.
Yeah, nobody.
Like, not once.
Not a friend?
Nope.
Nothing.
Nothing.
Not her sister?
No, not her parents. Nobody. Nope. Nobody who knew her talks to these people, which is interesting. Mm-hmm. We get a little bit of the hotel's history, that it was never luxury, but it didn't start out as the dive that it turned into. We get little sprinkles of getting to know Eliza through her social media, and that's just how the detectives and everybody that they interviewed, if they knew her at all, this is how they got to know her. So we kind of get to know her in the same way. The hotel is located in Skid Row, a 56 block area in downtown LA that is one of the poorest areas, not just in the US, but in the entire world. And there's a lot of complexity added to the disappearance because of this location. Determined to thwart any foul play and hopefully rescue Eliza, as they believe she's still in the building, the detectives begin to canvass the entire Cecil Hotel, all 700 rooms. They have to take a break before they're finished, and then the majority of their staff gets called away for another investigation that was more pressing.
Which is something we may actually remember.
Yeah.
Was this cop who was shooting at other cops. Like, we all kind of, I don't know, you might remember that. Mm-hmm. Like, that was a big deal. It was all over the news. And I remembered that, and I didn't remember this story.
No, not at all. Not at all. So the canvassing didn't really yield any clues, and the smaller staff couldn't canvas quite as effectively as the larger staff could. And so the police decide to share what little security footage they have of Eliza with the public. And it's troubling and confusing video of this young woman in an elevator. And this has the internet captivated.
Yeah, it won the internet.
It did. Reddit exploded.
Oh, yes.
And the episode ends.
You know what? It's still interesting.
It's still interesting.
It's still interesting, and I will tell you that at this moment, my son is at home watching this video because he walked in on me watching, I think it was actually the second episode, and he walked in and saw it, and then he's like, what's that? So I give him a little background, and he's like, what is that? All right. He's like, right in there, internet sleuth.
Oh, you got to have him watch episode 4.
Oh, he's going to watch the whole series, I think. Okay, good. He's going to be very interested in it. But he's super interested in this video, and I got to tell you, me too.
Well, yes.
Yeah, I got thoughts.
Yeah. Oh, good. Well, I want to hear all of them. Brian Tallarico writes for RogerEbert.com, which is my favorite. I've made no bones about it.
That's true.
But he said it's good. Much like the case it profiles, Netflix's crime scene vanishing at the Cecil Hotel is not what it first appears. It's better.
Yay!
Which I'm like, oh, that's good. And he said it's interesting, not so much because of the crime itself, which is, of course, interesting, fascinating, heartbreaking, all in equal measure.
Right.
But that there's a lot of issues around it. There's a lot of different things that play into how the investigation is carried out, what actually happened, what they believe happened. So it's more about the location, which makes it a good subject for a series called Crime Scene, where the scene is as much of a character, the location is as much of a character as any of the people.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The location, it absolutely stole and hijacked my attention.
Mm-hmm.
Not that Eliza doesn't bear a lot of my, you know, care and, you know, curiosity and, you know, just I want justice for her, etc. It's just that the location and talking about Skid Row had me like just, I'm on fire about it.
Yeah. Oh.
Right? Like, I was ashamed of myself for not being consciously aware. It's not like I didn't know Skid Row.
Right. Everybody's heard of Skid Row.
Everybody, yeah, they've heard of Skid Row. We kind of understand a little bit about it. Maybe even a little glamorized as the term mm-hmm. gets used in musicals. You know, like the same way that West Side Story kind of glamorizes gang violence, you know. But knowing about Skid Row and knowing about Skid Row is different. And I'm ashamed that I did not know. Aww. I think I care obviously more about my own town because that's where I'm at and maybe where I could do the most good or donate to the right places more easily to to help homeless. And we have issues in our town. And, you know, we had a recent issue where people were moved out from under an overpass where they had been living. It's very much our little Skid Row.
Right.
And we had even church under the bridge there. And they got, I mean, all the people had to get moved out. Church under the bridge was basically kicked out for a little while. Anyway, there's drama. And it's just really hard.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of maybe takes more of my attention. But this Skid Row issue, that is a world issue.
Well, and it's been going on for so long. Not that homelessness hasn't been going on for just
Skid Row
as long.
Has.
But Skid Row's like 100 years old.
It's created.
Yeah, we'll get there.
Yeah. There's so much about it. So it's a global issue. Like,
absolutely.
This is a humanitarian issue.
Well, because there's a Skid Row everywhere.
There is, but this one particularly is just...
Right. Exactly. Well, I mean, if we can understand what's going on in Los Angeles Skid Row, it'll help us better understand what's happening in any other sort of homeless community and what the factors are, which there are a lot.
A lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
His one critique, which I totally agree with, Crime Scene does suffer from the modern Netflix true crime problem that there's a tighter, better version that runs the length of a feature film.
Yeah.
Which I'm like... Totally fair.
It's totally fair. There's lots of slow pans into lots of Ken Burns kind of situations in the photographs and the
And he kind of sees the idea that nobody who actually knew Eliza was interviewed as a feature because it really helps us understand all of the detectives, the internet sleuths, all of these people who are trying to find out more information. There was nobody really who knew her in Los Angeles because she didn't know anybody in Los Angeles. So he kind of sees it as a feature, not a bug.
Yeah, I think that's true. It helps us to understand the mindset of somebody coming in the situation and investigating it for sure.
So Decider weighs in, decider.com, Joel Keller. And he talks about how what a good job it does of setting up both the mystery and the location and how well that works. And their call is to stream it. So that's great. They do a stream it or skip it.
Oh,
and they chose stream it.
Nice.
Which I was like,
all right.
Oh, good.
Good,
and,
good.
But not everybody agrees with that.
Yeah.
Mike Sarles of CNET said Netflix's Cecil Hotel documentary is a dangerous bloated mess. Which I was like,
dangerous, bloated,
Well, he says, it's bad. It's not just bad. Crime Scene, The Vanishing at the Cecil Hotel is bloated, dull, and confusing. hard disagree. But it's irresponsible and dishonest, indulging conspiracy theories that put already vulnerable victims at further risk. Which I was like, yeah, okay, I guess you have a little bit of a point there. But they're already out there. But I guess having them served up to you in this way, and then maybe if you don't finish the series, then you won't get a complete picture. You might continue to think that there's more things at play than there actually is.
I mean, I guess I could see that, but wouldn't that be true of anything that's a documentary? Like, if somebody just turns a movie off halfway, like, is it the movie's fault that you didn't read it to the end? Right. I mean, it's not the same thing as clickbait.
Right.
It's a story. It unfolds. And right. You have to go through it. But the fact that it is slower in some ways, mm-hmm. and it gives you time to kind of think and spin while it's getting to the next point. They're definitely playing with it. I can see that.
Yeah.
But dangerous?
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's basically what he says. These sleuths, the Cecil Hotel, indulges all types of conspiracy theories, lending them credence and respect throughout, only to reveal in the final 10 minutes that almost everything they said was complete beep.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
So he thinks that's a borderline dangerous technique. I think it's a way of telling the story. This is really, it's about the Cecil Hotel, but it's more about the internet, I think. It's more about the armchair detectives who desperately, desperately wanted to see Eliza Lam vindicated in some way. Yeah.
That's very true. And you know what? Investigations unfold one step at a time.
Right.
You know, like explaining how you think and where your mind's going, and the fact that you have to investigate all of the avenues from the least bizarre to the most bizarre based on the evidence that's there. And at the end of the day, the cops decided to release their crazy video.
Right.
Because they needed it. They needed some inspiration. And mm-hmm. they did get a little.
Right.
They got a little help with people being able to kind of say, all right, this is weird or not weird or whatever.
We're going to take a quick break. Join us when we come back when we talk about Is It True? Psychology Break and Real Life.
Scary stories aren't just for fiction novels. The most terrifying stories are the ones that actually happen. Nightmares brought to life. I woke up to a man standing over
put his hand over my mouth and I bit his finger as hard
to lure us deeper into the forest.
Was tapping on my window.
Something was scratching her up
the door.
And drag her into the woods. If you're fascinated by the morbid and sinister things this world is capable of, tune in to the Nightmare Society podcast. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast fix. New episodes every Thursday. Sweet dreams.
Thanks for staying with us through that little break. We are coming into our next segments, Is It True? Psychology Break and Real Life. And if you are new to us, you need to know how this works. So Miss Christie is going to wreck her internet history by researching all kinds of crazy things. And she's going to tell me about them and see if she can stump me, surprise me, or if I am right there with her. So stay tuned for these sections and we'll see if you are stumped, surprised, or right there with us. Mm-hmm. All right. So Christie, I know you've got some really cool stuff. So Is It True?
Is it true? So I thought we'd take a look at what some of the people we saw in the documentary are now doing, because many of them are not doing the things they were doing when poor Eliza Lam died. So Amy Price, she was the manager of the Cecil Hotel. It's a little bit of an interesting story how she ended up working for the Cecil Hotel. She didn't have any hotel management experience.
That blew my mind. They reveal that kind of in episode 2, right?
I think that
blew my mind.
Yeah. A friend of hers, her husband, evidently worked at the Cecil Hotel or in relation to the Cecil Hotel somehow. He needed somebody to come in and do this. And she said, one of my girlfriend's husbands needed help at the hotel and I wasn't working at the time. So I said, well, I've got time. I'll do it.
Wow.
That's a weird way to come into a hotel manager job.
Not just...
I've got time. I'll do it.
Not just any hotel manager job. This is like a freaking hotel on Skid Row.
Well, and she said she didn't even do any research on it. She didn't know even where in Los Angeles it was located.
Bless her heart.
I mean, well, here's the thing. Like, that's why nobody could... Nobody would do it because they knew it was the 700-room hotel on Skid Row that's got this wild past.
And wild present.
And yes.
Oh, my gosh.
And so she just really had no idea what she was
getting into
at all. And she's since gotten out of the business. She left that job in 2017, which I think she mentions.
Yeah, 10 years she was there.
That's a long time to be in a job where you really did. I mean, probably the first year she was just trying to figure out what was going on. And once she figured it out, like, okay, well, I guess I'll stay for a while since I took an entire year to figure stuff out.
I mean, I almost want to talk to her. I want to know more about her, about what made her stay. Did she have a mission that kind of came up, that welled up within her when she saw the problems and was like, I'm going to fix it? Like, did she just feel stuck or
was the money that great?
Yeah. I just want to know.
Yeah. It's interesting.
It's an interesting story.
Mm-hmm. Well, now she's got her own jewelry business and works as an interior designer in Los Angeles.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Well, she actually did a really good job with the redo when they did it. They changed it to stay on Main.
Right.
Right.
For part of it. Which was really weird.
That was a very innovative idea that she had to get around some... She's actually really smart.
Oh, yeah. It seemed like it.
Yeah. And the redo, all the rooms, she does have good style.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think the jewelry in the reenactments where they did a great job on their reenactments, yeah, I thought, in this, because they really never showed anybody's face. They were very artsy shots, mm-hmm. But they gave you just what you needed, just a little something visual to fill in, mm-hmm. that was interesting and pleasant to look at, and yeah. illustrated the story a little bit without having to, like, cast the people.
Right.
Well, what you always saw of Amy Price was her chunky, gorgeous bracelets.
Oh, yeah.
And I think those are hers.
Oh, that would make sense.
Yeah.
That would make sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because she made jewelry long before she took this job. And then when she left this job, that's when she decided to...
become a jeweler.
Yeah, and make it her career. So,
interesting.
Yeah. Tim Marsha was a detective on the case. He's since retired, and now he is co-owner of a website called Behind the Badge, where they cover crime and crime prevention, and they try and help the public understand how police work and firefighting is changing with technology. What are the challenges that they face in Southern California? So they've got like a reporting side to that, but they also do technical and creative consulting for Hollywood.
Well, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
That seems neat.
All right. So Greg Kading, another detective, no longer works for the police department, but previously he'd written a book, a self-published book. He's an author. The book he wrote was Murder Rap, The Untold Story of the Biggie Smalls and Tupac Shakur Murder Investigations.
What?
Which I was like, okay.
Ooh. Wait, they've done a recent thing that I didn't get to watch.
Uh-huh.
I didn't get to watch it, but I want to watch it.
Well, he makes a accusation based on the evidence that he had as part of being the detective in this.
Hmm.
And he said that Sean Combs had something to do with it. Sean Combs, you know, like P. Yeah. Diddy, Puffy.
I've been Puff saying Daddy. That since the morning of.
Really?
It happened. I was like, go get P. Diddy. He's done. I've been saying it for years.
Well, evidently he believes the evidence points that way.
A lot of people do.
A lot of people do. And of course, Sean Combs denies any involvement.
Of course. Of course, he made a lot of money on that song.
Mm-hmm.
Coming out.
Yeah.
No,
this story is pure fiction and completely ridiculous is the only comment that Sean Combs
will make. I mean, to be fair, he was never like charged, right? Exactly. Like, I don't, I'm not sitting here talking junk about P. Diddy, but that's what I thought too.
Okay. And I didn't know enough about it to have any kind of opinion. Jim McSorley, another detective, still works for the Los Angeles Police Department. He's now like a director type position where he works with detectives, mentors them, helps guide them. He's less field work, but he had a really like tough childhood growing up in New York in the 70s.
Ooh, yeah.
And that, I mean, I think growing up in New York in the 70s makes you want to be a mobster or a cop.
Yeah, somehow.
He went the cop route. Josh Dean was a journalist who appeared in this first episode, and he's written lots and lots and lots of articles about all different kinds of subjects. He runs a couple of podcasts, and it was his reporting on the Eliza Lamb story that got the attention of the filmmakers.
Oh, okay.
Mm-hmm. So it was published on Medium in a now defunct section of it called Matter back in 2015.
Okay. Huh.
Yeah.
Neat.
Then we have Dr. Douglas Mungin. He talked about Skid Row.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah, he's
okay,
the one who brought up containment and stuff like that.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Okay. He's a professor at Solano Community College in Vacaville, California, which is north of San Francisco. But he did his whole dissertation on Skid Row.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it was kind of interesting.
Yeah, that got it. I'm going to be reading more about that. In fact, I already started my YouTube rabbit trail.
Oh.
And then ended up sharing a video already. Like, yeah, I'm on a rabbit trail. So I might have to look him up some more.
Yes.
I bet he has some good stuff out there.
And then Kim Cooper, who was a historian.
Yes.
That they talked to. She started the 1947 Project, which was a blog that spawned Esoteric's popular crime bus tours.
Oh.
So there's a company called Esoteric where you can get on it's like the celebrity tours where you ride around on a bus.
Yeah.
And do that, except it's all crime stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, which I'm like, and that's an awesome name for.
That is really cool.
A touring bus sort of thing.
Yeah. I've done those crime tours before.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And ghost tours. Those are fun too.
Yeah.
They're all fun.
So now that we've gone through those people.
Okay.
Now it's is it true? So Amy Price, bless her heart, she said she thought 80 people died at the Cecil Hotel while she was there.
Yeah, she did say that.
Seems like an exaggeration because I looked up, now of course it's Wikipedia, but
yeah,
like their sources seemed pretty good. I counted since its inception in like 1925.
Mm-hmm.
18 deaths.
Oh, interesting.
And only two while Amy Price was manager, according to this. And this included not just like murders, but suicides and overdoses and things like that. So I don't know if there's things that went unreported or if these people were vagrants and so they're
not reported the same way. Well, because we know that's likely.
Right. So probably it's more than two, maybe less than 80.
I mean, if that's
it seems
true,
like a lot.
If there's 80 and you don't even see reporting close to that, that begs a whole nother list of questions.
Yeah.
Like, that's way more questions. Like, why?
Yeah. And she said, I don't know. I think I saw maybe 80, which is a lot. That's like 80 a year for 10 years. That's a lot. That's a lot of deaths in one location that's not a hospital or a nursing home.
Right.
I mean,
right.
Where else do that many people die in one location?
I mean, I don't know. I mean, that hotel is rough.
I mean, it is rough.
It's rough. I mean, there were some rough people.
Sticky floors.
The rough people who said they wouldn't even go above a certain floor because up there, anything goes. So who knows? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, the stories about how that operated, that was really interesting.
Yeah, and just, like, the cost. I mean, $1.50 for a room.
Yeah.
It, like, now, granted, that was, like, in the 30s and 40s.
But, yeah.
I mean, still not very much money.
No. Well, and then they said there were certain residents who were $14 a night or had a monthly rental of under $400.
Right.
Which I can understand these places being subsidized or offering it, but there didn't seem to be any commensurate security for what was happening there. And then there just seemed to be rampant amount of lawlessness that never got under control.
Right.
Right. And so why? But on the other hand, the city wanted it right there. So what can you do?
Right. Well, and that's just it. They had to offer affordable housing for part of it. That was part of the stay on main
situation.
But all of the resident areas and the stay on main and the low cost hotel, they all shared the same bank of elevators.
Yeah, they did.
And there's like virtually no security.
No, I mean, there should be, I mean, the amount of lawlessness going on with the just consistent drug use, prostitution, murder. I mean, hello, Night Stalker lived there.
We'll get there.
We'll get there. Ah! Okay.
So then Insider had some interesting facts.
Well, they better.
Way back 1947, Elizabeth Short was rumored to have stayed at the Cecil Hotel. So you may not know, recognize her name.
Oh, I know.
Oh, the Black Dahlia.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, who was like murdered, cut into pieces.
Yes.
Horrific, unsolved
story.
This was
just terrible.
Yeah. So there was one of the deaths, one of the 18 that showed up that I, on the list that I found, a teenage mother gave birth unexpectedly. She was 19.
Okay.
She did not know she was pregnant. She gave birth and she threw her newborn son out the window because she didn't know what else to do. Which is
That's
just
so
like,
sad.
It's so awful. And they ended up, they were going to charge her with murder and they ended up getting her psychiatric help, which I think probably what she needed. The Discovery Channel show Ghost Adventures just dedicated an episode to the Cecil because there's a lot of people who think there's like, it's the portal to hell.
Yeah.
There's like all kind. I mean, as many people, even if it's only 18 people who've died in that place, that's still quite a few for a place that's not a hospital or a nursing home.
Right.
So,
well, you even know, with like the elevator video, people were immediately like, ooh, there's something like supernatural going on here. Okay. All right. But
in case you missed that, that was a big eye roll from Jackie right there. And the episode, the whole season of American Horror Story that is about a hotel, all based on the Cecil Hotel. That was the inspiration for that whole
thing.
Wild, scary season. So, serial killers?
Yes.
Yeah. Richard Ramirez did indeed stay at the Cecil Hotel. Now, he's not believed to have killed anybody at the hotel.
No.
But they very specifically state that he would strip down to his underwear. He'd be bloody and he'd strip down to his underwear and throw the clothes away and people saw this and nobody questioned
it. And like
it.
He'd just like walk up the and stairs just all like, bloody and people are like, goes, all right.
Yeah, and they're like.
And he lived on the upper floors.
14th floor.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, you're going to get there. I have questions about the floors. So when we get there.
Oh, I don't really have a whole lot about the floors. I just know the upper floors were less well
patrolled.
There's
no 13th floor.
Oh, so he stayed on the 13th floor.
Yeah.
Oh.
And that's very common in Asia, right? And so.
It's common in the U.S.
Yeah, it's more common than I realized. I mean, when I lived in Korea, you saw it all the time, right? And so it was just common, like, whatever.
They skipped the number 13.
They just skipped the number 13, right? Like, mm-hmm. it doesn't make it any less the 13th floor.
That's right.
But nevertheless, it's always a thing. But when she said that, and she said it so flippantly, I'm talking about Amy Price. She kind of said, uh-huh. you know, there's whatever, maybe floors, maybe skip the 13th. And she kind of went on, and I was like, what? Really? I didn't know that was common here? Or maybe, like... That's interesting. Mm-hmm. But he freaking lived on the 13th floor.
He sure did. Oh, I had not made that connection.
Super creepy.
It is super. It's still the 13th floor, even though they listed it as the
14th. Yeah, but that's creepy. And the historian, I love what she said about it, because she was like, it just tells you what kind of place it was that this individual felt comfortable coming home here and letting his hair down. Like. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. He knew he could go back to his room covered in blood and nobody and would stop him. And
he
didn't
have to act. Yeah. He didn't have to put on a...
Nobody would stop him.
No.
But they mentioned serial killers.
They did, didn't they? It was plural.
Yeah. So more than one. So the other one is a little less well known, particularly in the U.S. His name was Jack Unterweger.
No, I'm not familiar with this.
Okay. So he was an Austrian man.
Okay.
And he had grown up as the child of a sex worker mm-hmm. and maybe had a little damage from growing up in that environment. And he, in 1976, murdered an 18-year-old German woman, Margaret Schaefer, and he strangled her with her own bra. And they put him in prison, mm-hmm. and he was supposed to serve a life sentence.
Okay.
After just 15 years of his life sentence, he was released. And here's why. He wrote a book, because he was a very intelligent man. Mm-hmm. And so he wrote a book that was very popular called Purgatory or The Trip to the Prison, The Report of a Guilty Man. So he wrote this autobiographical book. And... it was very popular, and he seemed very lucid and contrite. And so they released him, thinking that he was indeed reformed.
Oh.
And so he left Austria to go be a reporter. And he went so far as to arrange ride-alongs with the Los Angeles Police Department and to, like... under the guise of being a reporter. Meanwhile, he strangled three more sex workers while he was staying at the Cecil Motel. I don't believe they were in the motel, but he strangled them with their own bra while he stayed at the hotel and while he was doing ride-alongs with the police officers under the guise of being a reporter. And they... it took them a long time to connect these dots.
Oh, my God.
And they finally did, and he was sentenced to another life prison, and then he hanged himself.
Guess so. He didn't have another book in him.
I guess he's like, another book's not going to get me out of prison this time.
Nope, he's done that time.
Yep.
Oh, man. Yep.
The last bookstore
that
Eliza Lamb went to, oh, indeed, huge, fantastic. It's the largest... new and used bookstore in Los Angeles.
Okay.
22,000 square feet. Enormous. And they have a whole new news section, used section, arts and rare books. They have a vinyl records collection that you can go shop, but you can only shop the vinyl records collection in person.
No.
Which stinks.
Yeah.
But...
well, yeah. If you go, don't stay. Don't stay on Main.
I won't stay. Oh, no. I'm not going to stay on Main or the Cecil.
And I feel bad because I just hate to think that there's no future, but don't do it.
No.
Don't do it.
There's a reason why the only people who weren't familiar with the area who stayed there were from other countries.
Yeah.
There's a reason for that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or stayed there only because it was such a great deal.
Yo, because it's a hostel. And there's not a lot of hostels in the U.S.
Mm-mm.
So if you are used to being able to travel that way and being able to do that, Mm-hmm. It's not a lot of option here.
Right.
You don't get that.
Right. There's hostel rooms and non-hostel rooms.
Yeah.
And
so, yeah. You know, if you've ever done that in Europe, you know, it's a very normal thing. Uh-huh. But here, not so much.
Yeah. Well, because Liza did stay in a bunk room.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, where you had to walk down the hall and go to the bathroom.
It's a dorm.
And, yeah.
Yep.
For $85 a night.
Yeah, I know. But, whoo. Yeah. Bring your shower shoes and your shower bucket. Mm-hmm.
I don't know, for $85 a night, even in Los Angeles, I think I want my own place. But
I mean, it is a lot of money for a hostel. Usually, it'd be far less.
And, yeah.
And there'd be food somehow.
Yes.
Usually. Yes.
So the Christopher Dorner shootings
was
absolutely a thing. He was a former police officer who maybe some mental issues, maybe some legitimate grievances. Yeah. Legitimate grievances are not, maybe don't start shooting police officers and their family members. And
still not a good idea.
Really not a good idea, but that definitely happened right at the exact same time that this investigation was going on. So there are some myths about Skid Row.
Okay, hit me.
So is Skid Row the result of a containment policy? Mm-hmm. Yes and no.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Okay.
I'm sure that there's a lot. It's a more complex story than just containment.
Right.
But intention impact situation?
Yes. Okay. So the Skid Row Housing Trust says that the concentration of homelessness in Skid Row is a result of containment policy is a myth.
Mm.
Because there is a very large homeless population in Los Angeles, 88,000.
Mm-hmm.
But there's only a few thousand who remain in Skid Row. So they're in Skid Row. They're not kept there now.
Mm-hmm.
So Skid Row isn't a result of a containment policy now.
Not now.
But there was a containment policy that created it originally.
Yeah.
So,
and now it's kind of one of those systemic containments because all the shelters, all the ministries, all the people, they're only zoned there, or they were only zoned there when they opened. And so that's where they are. So all the resources for individuals in the city, if you wanted to, you know, avail yourself of public resources or charitable resources, you've mm-hmm. got to get yourself to Skid Row.
Right. Yes.
And then once you're there, you're stuck.
Right. Yeah, because that's the only resources.
Yeah.
So, yeah, how do you leave those things behind? And mm-hmm. They said the only solution to end homelessness in Skid Row is to prevent homelessness by addressing the economic factors and system failures that cause homelessness and provide permanent housing that meets the economic, health, and social needs of those individuals who are currently without a home.
That's right.
I mean, really.
That's right.
Yeah.
I am all on board for these cities who are doing the tiny home thing. They're really trying to build places. And I know that's hard because, you know, you're trying to force people into a lifestyle that they are not living in, which sounds ridiculous. You would think that all the homeless just want to get off the street immediately. But there's actually still a mental process to change the way you live, to feel the claustrophobia of being in a space when your entire security has been that you have eyes everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
There's a mental process. You can't just force somebody to go indoors like that and be like kind of locked in and them not feel fear. It's an insecure situation because they don't understand it or know it yet. Anybody you're trying to help in that situation who has experienced homelessness chronically, especially, you're asking them to change their entire life on a promise you're giving them. And that's a little scary. So I think we as a society have to do more to establish our promise
mm-hmm.
well, and make it worth trusting.
And it's such a challenge because those people go from distrusting police
mm-hmm.
To now suddenly you need to provide them a place to live. Well,
yeah.
Okay. So you provide them a place to live, but if that place is concentrated, then there's more chance that there's going to be crime or victimization.
That's right.
In that area. But to provide them security,
they provide them the very thing that exacerbates the problem.
Well, Exactly. Yeah. So that's a frightening situation because they've learned to not trust police, not trust authority figures because nobody's helped them.
Right. It's very complex when you, and you know, and then something we don't think about a lot, but a lot of the shelters, a lot of the resources, they don't allow pets.
Right. And that's,
this is a travesty because so many of our homeless, you know, individuals in our community have pets and this is their lifesaver. If they're out there for any reason that has to do with mental health, especially, and, you know, maybe say PTSD all the way to even depression, these animals are what gives them the support and kind of the purpose and the hope to keep going one step at a time and continue to survive and look for the future. And you want them to go somewhere and then just and not just have their animals separated. They have to abandon the animal to ACS.
Yeah.
That's... So now, who's going to go?
Right. Well, I mean,
I wouldn't go.
This has been their security. You know, when they sleep, they know their dog is going to wake up and bark.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's like saying, oh, you came to the shelter with your baby. You have to surrender that to DPS now.
Right.
That would be ridiculous, right? Even at the border.
Yeah.
Sorry. I went there. That would be ridiculous.
I agree that it's ridiculous.
You don't just surrender your family and you know, that's hard. Yeah, so we have to, those are like those little logistical things that you have to worry about. It's hard.
It is super, super, super hard. But what is, something I wondered, where did the term Skid Row come from?
Oh yeah, totally Googled it too. So I'm right there with you. Yes. I totally did. Okay, all right, good. So talk about this.
Okay, so it has to do with logging communities. So they would send logs down greased roads on skids. Mm-hmm. And to make sure all the logs stayed, you had people who rode down the logs on the skids with the logs.
Yeah.
And when they got to the bottom, they didn't have anything to do. So once you get the skids off of there, you don't have anything to do, so you just sit around waiting for your transportation to go back up and do it again. Well, the transportation doesn't want to go up and down, up and down, up and down. They let a whole group of people gather, and then they go down and get them all at once and bring them back up.
So makes the idea sense, is you're kind of...
Yeah, that these were poorly paid people who didn't have much to do, except when they had a whole lot to do. And that's kind of where
and
this
I kind
came
of
from.
Thought of the idea of you're on your way down.
Yeah.
And you're on your way to rock bottom and you're on your way to, and so, you know, and then the idea that you're on these skids, which are movable and portable and nomadic, right? Because you use skids to pallets. Y'all, pallets. Yeah. So and so all of that, and so all these people started have a connotation of you know, people who are like that, who are the skids.
Yeah. Well, and they're kind of disposable.
Yeah.
It was a dangerous job that didn't pay very well, but you didn't have to be well educated to be able to deal with it. So
all kinds of metaphors in there that created.
Geez.
Kind of sounds fun.
To ride the skids down?
Like legitimately, like back in the day. Yeah, like, oh, actually sounds fun.
Yeehaw!
I mean, right? Like that's kind of, I get paid to like, wee! And then sit around? I get it. Yeah. I'm just making fun.
Yeah.
Sitting around's a lot different now than it was then.
That also very true. Very true. So the police did release this video.
Oh, yes. Okay, good. Yay.
Okay, so I wanted to find out what some of the circumstances around releasing a video would be.
Okay.
Because I can see where they really struggled with it.
Yeah.
They really struggled with, are we going to release this video? And it was not until, like, most of their task force got pulled away for the Dorner investigation that they were like, we're just out of options. We have to release this. So, Police One had 9 considerations for police when requesting public assistance during a manhunt. So, I thought some of these were interesting. I thought I'd talk about it. So, public endangerment is like the big one. Mm-hmm. If people are going to be endangered because there's a manhunt, which is the kind of the whole Dorner thing, the public was in danger. So, they had to loop in the public to this. But they also look at the integrity of the investigation. They don't release things that could compromise the investigation, right. but enough to be able to determine if somebody actually knows something. Mm-hmm. And so they have to examine that. That's one thing that they would have to consider, the seriousness of the crime. Mm-hmm. If they believe that the person obviously is a threat to the public at large or a threat to a particular individual or, mm-hmm. you know, somebody's been murdered, that kind of thing takes part into it. They also have to look at their current evidence, mm-hmm. which makes sense. But when you think about it, this was really interesting. Releasing information about a wanted suspect will probably not be too much of a concern for the career criminal, but it can have a devastating impact on a person who has no criminal record, especially if the suspect later turns out to be innocent.
Yeah.
So they kind of have to weigh that. Do we really think this person did it? Are we certain this person did it and we need to look for them? Or do we merely want to question them? Because right. even releasing somebody's name as somebody they want to question can really be detrimental to somebody who's innocent.
Right.
Yeah.
It makes sense.
Mm-hmm. One of the ones they mentioned is running out of options.
That's what
which
the
is,
cops said in the show.
That's exactly where these police officers were. These detectives were just mm-hmm. out of options. And the methods of releasing this information, they said it's actually done way more often than you realize mm-hmm. because they do it at the street level.
Oh, okay.
They
yeah,
might release,
right. That makes sense.
They're talking to an individual. Mm-hmm. They might release a little bit of information about the case to the individual that they're talking to in order to get more information or to find a suspect, mm-hmm. something like that. And then, of course, you know, they might put it on their website or social media, which is
right.
what happened.
Yeah.
All right, psychology break.
Okay.
All right.
Psychology
so
break.
You and I had chatted a little beforehand. You're going to tell us a little bit about, so you don't find out till later mm-hmm. after the first episode, but you do find out that part of the right. reason that her family was so intent on her checking in every day was because mm-hmm. she was taking medication for depression and other mental illnesses.
Right. She said bipolar.
Yes.
And she said it on her social media.
Right.
That bipolar sucks. She's not wrong. It does. She talked about the depression also. And really what you hear her talking about with the medicine is, yeah, she was on medicine for the depression side is what that was. Based on what she kind of said, all right, so the social media and what she kind of revealed, there's two different types of bipolar. So there's bipolar, which we all think of, and that used to be called manic depressive, mm-hmm. right? Or manic depression. And that's the point is that you're really, really high one day and then you're really, really low another day. And it doesn't really cycle that fast usually, but mm-hmm. a season of time. How fast you move for those highs and lows is your cycling. You tend to have a rhythm of cycling, and rapid cycling up and down really, really quick is a very bad thing. It's a complication of it. It's a progression of it. It's just not good. But so that's bipolar one, right? Mm-hmm. Bipolar two is similar, except that really what it is you have you have the manic depressive side, the bipolar plus major depressive disorder, MMD. So, or MDD, excuse me. So when that's together, what you get is really low lows and not so high, but a little manic. So it's called hypomanic. Right. So you're not like manic, like bipolar one, where you might have like hallucinations and actually have psychosis or a break from reality or mm-hmm. Grandiose thoughts and delusions. That's where you get people who are like, no, I really can fly. Watch. Right.
Uh-huh.
They're just like, I am on top of the world. Yes. You know, uh-huh. that's that manic that we kind of think of. It's stereotypical. The hypomania. For a lot of people who have bipolar too, they are waiting for the hypomania because this is where they get all their crap done. They're like, oh, finally, I'm going to clean the house, top to bottom. I'm going to mow the lawn. I'm going to get all my work done. They get ahead.
Yeah.
A lot of artists, this is where they're like, yes, I'm motivated now. I have energy now. I can focus now. They're in it. So it's actually kind of beneficial. See, but what's ironic about it is that is that you actually, because you're on a lower shelf, I guess, you dip way, way lower.
Oh.
So the depression is way worse.
Yeah.
And it lasts for way longer. So the cycling in the bipolar 2 is slower usually, and a rapid cycling in that is concerning also. Mm-hmm. But anytime right. you're rapid cycling,
yeah,
that's really not good.
So she probably had to have been like maybe off her meds the whole time she was traveling. Well,
she said she was trying a new depressive medicine, right? That's uh-huh. what she said on her. And so likely she was taking some kind of antidepressant. And she had been looking for the one that actually works. So because of the way that they said that, I kind of read into it that she must be bipolar too. That's why I really focused on the depression medicine.
Okay.
Because there, you know, for a bipolar one, you're going to be very, very concerned about the manic, because that's where people end up in harming themselves accidentally, on purpose. The hallucinations can be terrifying.
Was she maybe misdiagnosed as bipolar 2 when she was really bipolar 1? Because that would explain the erratic behavior in the...
Well, I don't know. When I looked at it, there's 100 things that could explain the erratic behavior.
Okay.
So, okay. I don't know. But the fact that she talks so much about being depressed, I feel okay. like that was more of a thing in her life. And if that's the case, the hypomania wouldn't have looked like that much. And if she really was, I mean, if she really was, she should have been on lithium instead of an antidepressant, right? So I don't know. Like, it's all conjecture, right?
Right. Well, because all we have to go on is, you know, media. Internet sleuths is mm-hmm. her social media.
Yeah. I mean, obviously she has like a lot of drive, and that's uh-huh. a good thing. And so maybe it was, I don't know. You don't really know. All we know is that she did have bipolar and that was a concern. In that case, she really shouldn't have been traveling alone.
Really?
She really shouldn't have been traveling alone, because if something changes and her medication isn't working properly, you know, she needs to be able to. So unless she had a very mild case, but she's at that age range. She was at 21.
Uh-huh.
This is where this comes to light. This is that time. And so maybe if you're like a 40-year-old like me
uh-huh.
and you have bipolar, maybe you can let me travel alone. I've lived with it for a long time. Chances are I've shown myself to be compliant to my medication, uh-huh. aware of my triggers.
Jackie's not bipolar. She's using herself as an example.
No, that's true. I'm not bipolar. But if I was, right, yes. then you could let me go out. Right. I wouldn't let a young girl who's 21.
Yeah.
Because chances are she's recently diagnosed, and by recent, even in a couple of years, that's still pretty recent. And obviously they hadn't settled her antidepressants well.
Yeah.
So I don't know that I would let her travel alone yet. I mean, uh-huh. it's kind of like,
but she's an adult. Let her travel alone. Okay.
Yeah,
I mean, you're right. It's the kind of thing that's like, it's such a difficult line to walk, because really mm-hmm. somebody should have told her, you need to have a companion go yeah. with you.
Right.
You really do, for your own safety.
Mm-hmm. I mean, her parents obviously said, she even asked. She asked her parents. So she was cognizant enough to say, hey, you know, let me go. Mm-hmm. And obviously had that respect for them. And they said, just check in every day. But maybe the answer should have been, all right, but you need to have a friend with you.
Yeah.
Right? Like, or at least in every city. And when you check in, you need to be staying with that friend.
Yeah.
So that the fun is the traveling from one place to another, you know, and checking in every day, but there's actual eyes on the ball every city.
Uh-huh.
Right? Aww. Just to kind of, but hindsight is 2020, right?
Well, right. Exactly. I mean, I wouldn't fault her parents.
No, I don't at all. They did that. I mean, that. And you know what? As soon as she missed a call, they were on it. So, I mean, I think they did everything they knew how to do at the time. But mm-hmm. but I think you can learn that lesson and say, hey, if a 20-something-year-old who's fairly recently diagnosed-ish or has any kind of flux in their medication, then if you are that person, if you have bipolar and you're in that situation, you know, for your own safety, I would say the checking in every day is great, but that's an only after the fact situation.
Right.
Whereas a friend with you could probably, you know, help you much better.
Well, make good choices,
mm-hmm.
you know, help yeah. you stay calm, mm-hmm. inform somebody if you're not.
Yeah. Right. I mean, yeah. there's just, you know, things about that, but who knows? I mean, her death, anybody was vulnerable.
Well,
in that situation, for sure. So we can't blame her being bipolar.
No, for her death
either.
No.
You know, it was the elevator video. Yeah, it'd be easy to call that manic, but that video was really crappy quality.
As far as witnesses are concerned, it sucks. Yeah.
So you don't really know if she. I mean, shoot, I might look really manic if you were to catch a video of me somewhere and nobody was looking. Especially in an elevator by myself. Who knows what I'm singing or acting out? Come on now.
I'm talking to myself out loud.
Right.
And there's no audio, so we can't hear what she's saying.
You have
no idea.
She might
have been like talking about who knows what. She might have. I don't know. I'm sure I sound like a lunatic.
Like what dance moves was she's going through and going, why isn't the elevator closing? Uh-huh. Anybody here? Did somebody press the button?
Uh-huh.
Back to dancing. I mean, who knows?
Right.
And it could have been very innocent.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so,
well, yeah. If you're interested in reading her Tumblr, it can be a little challenging to find. So mm-hmm. I'm going to post a link to that on our social media. And you can find us on Facebook, Killer Fun Podcast, exploring the intersection of crime and entertainment. You can find us on Twitter at Killer Fun Pod. Or you can send us an email, killerfunpodcast@gmail.com.
Yep.
All right. Real life.
All right. What you got?
All right. Roseville, Michigan Police Department put together a very helpful list of what you should do if someone goes missing, if a loved one goes missing.
Okay.
So don't panic.
Okay.
Your first thing shouldn't be like complete freak out. They want you to take a deep breath and think, okay, call the family and friends.
Yeah.
Anybody that they've had contact with, call those people first. Mm-hmm. And keep your phone with you in case they need to try and reach you. Remember that if this person's an adult, it's not illegal for them to go missing. They can intentionally go missing. And that happens sometimes, even when you're not expecting it. But if your missing person is vulnerable, they're elderly, they're under 18, they take medication that they need to survive, and you know for a fact they do not have that with them, you should report their disappearance to the police immediately. It is never too soon when your person goes missing and they are vulnerable in some way for you to report them missing.
Right.
It is never too soon. That these first few hours after they go missing are the most important. Now, hopefully you find them. All is well. They went to the movies and forgot to text you, or they had a car accident and their phone broke and they weren't able to call you, but they're fine.
Yeah, right.
These are things that happen. But, you know, if they had a car accident and, the police are involved, they might be able to help you find that person relatively quickly. So, you know, you should get things together, like photo, date of birth, physical description, if you know what they were wearing, you know, different things like that. You should get all that together, and that the police, if it is ongoing, they're going to want to see bank records and social media and things like that. Hopefully it doesn't get to the point where they start asking for dental records and DNA samples, but that happens.
Mm-hmm.
And under their do not do, they stress again, don't panic. try not to panic, because you being upset is actually really unhelpful.
Right.
Again, don't wait if this person is vulnerable in some way. You should start searching, especially now that we have cell phones.
Right.
It used to be when I was a kid, they'd tell the parents to stay at home.
Right.
Because kids are going to be home.
Yeah.
They're going to come home when they're, you know, done with whatever tomfoolery they've been up to.
Right.
They're going to come home and you want to be there.
Yeah.
Now they're like, go. You have your cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
Go to the places you think that they might be and keep your cell phone charged and with you. Don't keep their disappearance a secret. Share it as far and wide as you can, because the more people who hear about it, the more likely they are to be able to help.
Right.
This is the one that kind of made me think about Eliza Lamb is don't tidy up their bedroom or their car until the police have seen it. Now, it makes sense that a hotel would do that. Yeah. And we'll get there in a minute. But, you know, don't delete their text messages. Don't alter their social media accounts, even if you think those things are embarrassing, which sometimes they are extremely embarrassing. It can be vital information. Yeah. If your person is missing and if the police don't take you seriously, that their suggestion is to keep after it.
Okay.
Keep looking and keep
calling them.
Keep calling the police.
Okay.
That you know your person who's missing mm-hmm. better than they do. And if you feel like something's wrong, keep calling.
Right.
Keep calling. I need your help. And never, ever put your phone number on missing posters. The police will provide you with a phone number. You put the police department's phone number, or they'll provide you with a number of a hotline that people can call, because you can be the victim of a hoax.
Yeah.
As horrible as that is.
Horrible.
You don't want somebody I know where they are, but I need $5,000 to tell you.
That's awful. Plus your phone blowing up with false information. Uh-huh. Like, let other people who know how to filter that stuff fast.
Exactly. So eviction sounds terrible, but really, by the time you get to eviction, there's a very long, usually, history of non-payment.
Yeah.
It is an absolute last resort because it's expensive.
It's not easy to evict someone.
No, it's expensive. You have to go to court. It's a big pain in the behind.
It's actually hard to evict someone who's a squatter in your own property.
Yes.
I mean, it's not easy to evict. If you have an eviction on your record,
It was really willful disregard for the property that you're staying in.
Right.
Is so.
Now, there is something else that you can look for that maybe less when people think of eviction. But people sometimes break their contracts early, mm-hmm. and that might be on your record. And that may be a little less nefarious because that could be for multiple reasons.
You're military, and I know in our area, mm-hmm. a lot of people put a military clause in. If you get orders, you can submit those orders and break your lease. Mm-hmm. And
there can be reasons.
Right. But it can actually be cheaper to live in a hotel than an apartment.
Okay. Yes. There was a whole thing about this for like retirement. It was like a joke about like a guy who retired and did the math, and he was like, forget this. I'm going to go live in a luxury hotel the rest of my life because it's cheaper than like all this other places.
Well, and there was the little old lady who was on a cruise for like 18 months straight because it was cheaper to book 2 or 4 week cruises than stay in a retirement community. Yeah. She's like, there's a doctor on board. All my meals are taken care of. My room is clean.
I got the drink package.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, most people prefer the stability mm-hmm. of a home, but if you might have a job that requires you to travel a lot. Mm-hmm. So if you're only going to be somewhere for 3 or 4 weeks at a time, it might make sense to have a home base, but not necessarily a home at your home base.
Well, there's some hotels that are kind of geared towards that.
Uh-huh.
And then there's some hotels that kind of have both available, right? So my dad was a consultant. So he really always lived somewhere else and came home on weekends.
Okay.
So his contract could be a year, a couple of years, 6 months or whatever. And so sometimes they would rent him an apartment somewhere. Uh-huh. But most of the time, these are the places he stayed.
Yeah.
So the Residence Inn was very popular because it was a good suite, had a nice small kitchen, mm-hmm. not really a kitchenette, like a small kitchen.
Okay.
But they still had meals available and things of that sort. So you didn't have to stock it and then clear it out for the weekend when you go home. And business travelers use them all the time. And there was times where he had an apartment that was the same hotel room over and over for, uh-huh. and that way he could have a home base, and that was easy as pie. And we could visit him.
Yeah.
Right. We could go and see him because he wasn't just checking into a hotel with whatever rando room that he might get. And it's like,
No, he knew what to expect mm-hmm. when you got there.
Yeah. Six month rental. Right. Mm-hmm. So actually my dad did this all the time.
That's very cool. And it can actually really be like way cheaper. Mm-hmm. So this article on anyplace.com by Joe Frabotta details This article is from 2019.
Okay.
So relatively recent. You know, the before times, but the just before times.
Yeah.
So in 2019, the average rent in San Francisco for an apartment was $3,933. And you could stay at the Admiral Hotel for a month for $1,780.
No way. See, that's crazy.
In Montreal, an apartment was $940 a month. And the Sojourn Hotel was $875 a month.
I mean, ridiculous, right?
In New York City, $3,519. $400 cheaper than San Francisco, by the by.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could stay at the Studios 99 Hotel for $1,767 yep. a month.
Done.
So, I mean, and somebody's going to come in and clean.
There you go. Cleaning, room service, maybe a restaurant on site.
They're going to wash your sheets yeah. for you. They're going to wash your towels for you. Mm-hmm. You're still going to have to wash your own undies, probably. But
there's laundry service. You can pay for that.
Yeah, you can pay for that. Mm-hmm. And for the $2,000 you save,
yep.
maybe it's worth it.
Yeah, because yeah. it's... You know, it might be more expensive than going to a laundromat, but it takes the burden away. Uh-huh. Somebody else can do it. And yeah, it's luxury living, man.
Yeah. I mean, I just couldn't believe. And you might have a gym.
Yes.
$3,500 in New York City, you're probably not getting a gym.
Maybe outdoor space, even a garden of yeah. some sort that you could go out to walk. Yeah. And a pool, hot tub, jacuzzi, maybe massage services that can be. Yeah. Well, I mean, if you think about it, these independent living places that are popping up all over the place are structured after a hotel.
Right.
This is how that works. My right. dad is in one. I'm mm-hmm. like, why not me? I mean, I don't know. When are we going to start building this stuff for us?
Uh-huh.
And I guess there are called hotels, but I'm talking about like full on where everybody is a monthly rental and everybody can like live there and have all of these services. I'm talking about all-inclusive living, y'all. It'd be cheaper. It'd be less stress.
Says the woman who just replaced her air conditioning unit.
Yep. Not the first one I've ever had to replace either, but you know.
All right. So Kim, the hotel manager, mentioned that a lot of weird stuff had been left in the hotel.
I can't even imagine.
So she said the weirdest thing she could think of off the top of her head was that somebody left a live snake
oh, yeah.
in a bathtub. And so I was like, what other weird stuff?
Oh, God, I can't even imagine. So I brace myself.
Oakwood Resorts has an article from 2018 on their website. Now, I couldn't tell from the article whether all these things were left in their facilities or okay. if these were a compilation of things. But all real things
okay.
that have been left in hotel rooms. A dead alligator.
Florida.
I'm sure. This one's a quote. Cats everywhere, and a $100 tip with a note that said, "Thanks for taking care of these guys. I'll be back in a week." She never came back. She abandoned cats. Ah, poor kitties.
Maybe she's missing.
Oh, that didn't even occur to me. Oh,
maybe they should have called somebody. I mean, she left the money, and that's her cats. People don't just leave their cats.
Some do. Mean, awful people.
Mean people.
A goat
dressed as
Abraham Lincoln. Not just a goat dressed as Abraham Lincoln.
Mm-hmm. Trying to picture this right now. Okay.
Oh, the top hat.
I mean, beard. It's adorable.
Uh-huh.
How adorable.
It, really cute. A suitcase full of prosthetic legs.
Oh, God.
That's a hell of a sales thing to lose if you're the salesman for the prosthetics right? company. A bathtub full of potatoes. I don't know. Six full-size, fully decorated Christmas trees in one room. I don't know. I don't know why. I'm all for joy. But now this one makes sense, but also doesn't. A glass eye and a glass of water. because I can see, like, it's a thing. You put it down, you take it out, you, like, put it down, and you're, you know, good to go. But you leave without it?
I mean, maybe he has two. Oh. Maybe somebody had two and, like, left one cleaning. And it's like when you have two sets of contacts or something like that, and you leave one, you're like, crap.
They're pretty expensive. They're really usually expensive. You don't have two.
I mean, I don't know. I mean, I don't know why you wouldn't want two, though, because I feel like I would have to, like, if I'm cleaning one, I'd like to just have the other in.
Yeah.
I'm not eyeless, by the way. I don't. This is all conjecture. I'm just saying that if I...
Yeah, seems like the kind of thing you would want. I don't know. All the room furniture nailed to the ceiling. Just a level of dedication to a prank that I am unwilling to...
That's right.
...go through.
Yeah.
A Swarovski-encrusted 5-foot wedding cake.
Whoa. Whoa.
Yeah.
Hello. Wow.
Yeah. And a bag of snails. I don't know.
I feel like a kid did that.
Yeah.
I feel like parents were like, let's go. And she had been outside.
You're not bringing the snails home.
They're not doing it.
They are not coming home. So what happens to items that are left behind? It depends on the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, policies vary. Usually they will collect the items, mark them with the room number and the name of the person who was there, and keep them for a certain amount of time.
Makes sense.
Then donate them if it's not... claimed. But they will not call you if you leave something in a hotel room, which I've actually left something in a hotel room. We stayed in a condo in Florida for fun. We met family there and they had a washer and dryer, and I left bathing suits in the dryer.
Oh, man.
And I'm like, bathing suits are expensive. So I paid the $15 or $18 to have them shipped back to us, whatever it was. Some places will do it for free. Some places charge you. Usually they'll keep it. But Tammy Geist Long answered a question about what happens to those things. And she said she worked in a hotel in Vermont, and their hard and fast rule was you never call anybody to let them know because they have no idea what the home situation is.
Right.
Because it maybe they said they were there with their wife, but you call their house and my husband was at a convention in a different city that weekend. He wasn't at your hotel in Vermont.
Right. Exactly. That so makes sense.
They, if you forget something and you realize it,
you have to call.
You have to call. They will not call you.
That makes sense. Well, they'd be doing that all the time. They'd have to hire somebody full time to handle all that with all the stuff they just left behind anyways. And, so like not only would it be like, oh, sticky situations, but also like, gosh, that would be arduous.
Yep.
Nah.
And that's all I have.
Oh, man. That was a lot, though. Yeah. That goat.
That goat.
I'm going to have to be looking up pictures of goats dressed like Abraham Lincoln now.
Why would somebody abandon such cuteness?
I mean, I love goats.
I mean, I do, too.
They're so sweet.
They're sweet, and they're funny.
And they're cuddly.
Uh-huh.
I love them.
And sometimes if you scare them, they'll flop over on their back and put their feet in the air.
Fainting goats are so funny.
They're so cute and
you could
funny.
Just go down a rabbit trail watching fainting goats.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, this whole series, wow.
Yeah, it's a lot.
It was a lot. Like, it's my mind was churning. It's brought up some social issues, some ethical issues. Like, it's brought up issues.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, from the location to what happened to her and what they believe ultimately happened to her. And it's a lot.
It's a lot.
So next time we're going to do something fictional.
Yeah, let's do something fictional next time.
Woo-hoo! Yeah, there's a new show on Netflix called The One.
I love this.
Which they analyze DNA and find your perfect match.
Mm-hmm. Which is a little like that movie we watched, which was the sci-fi noir with the...
Gattaca.
Gattaca.
Uh-huh.
I was about to say The Beautiful House.
Uh-huh.
Yes. A little
that
bit
would be the thing that
where
Jackie...
she, you know, they go and they test the DNA to see if there's anything wrong with you.
Right.
Which is, you know, but in this case, they're trying to match you.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so I can't wait to see. And there's a murder in it. So that's where it gets crimey. So, yeah, it's super interesting. I like barely started to watch it. Mm-hmm. It's a, I think you had to pay attention, but we'll, so, you know, yeah. But we'll help you make sense of it.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. So go watch it and then we'll figure it all out together.
That's right. And join us next time. And until then, be safe, be kind, and wash your hands. Bum, bum, bum. Bum, bum. Da, 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 da.